Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 10th, 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby from BeerAndWineJournal.com and I talk about brewing triples. This Trappist-inspired style is light in color, very tasty, and one of my favorites. The ingredient list is simple, but fermentation is where you need to pay a bit of attention. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, BasicBrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first and click on our associate link on the right-hand side of our basicbrewing.com page. It'll take you back to Amazon where you can shop as you normally do. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be helping us to bring you the show. We greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows Phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. If you listened last week and are following me on Twitter and Facebook, you know that I'm in the process of brewing an Oktoberfest, or at least my take on an Oktoberfest for a gathering on October 17th. And I racked a secondary on Monday and got a bit of a surprise. This is a 100% Vienna beer, 100% Vienna malt, the first that I've done, and the fermentability was a lot lower than I expected. Vienna is kilned to be darker than most base malts, but it still has enough enzymatic activity to convert in the mash. The fermentation looked great. The yeast was very happy, but after, you know, a couple, 3 days, I brought it out of the kegerator where it was at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. I let it warm up to do a diacetyl rest. So I don't think the Oktoberfest yeast got stuck in any way. The beer tastes good, but it's I'm gonna call it an accidental session beer because it just didn't ferment out like I thought it should. The beer is now in secondary in a carboy in the kegerator, and I'm ramping the temperature down before putting it into the keg. And I'm just wondering if you've done 100% Vienna malt beers and what your experience has been. Maybe I should have done a step mash with a lower initial rest temperature to bring up the fermentability a bit. I'll keep you posted. It doesn't taste too sweet. It tastes nice and malty, but it's fairly well balanced. And so it's not syrupy by any stretch of the imagination. So I still think it's going to be a tasty beer, especially after it's carbonated in the keg. But I was just interested to see if the lower fermentability was something I should have expected on the front end. I got this on the subject of quick lagers from Nate in Concord, New Hampshire. Nate says, for a fast lager, I have done a few of them by starting the lager at 50 degrees Fahrenheit for a couple days, then bring it up 2 degrees a day until 64 degrees, until it's just about finished, and then 68 to get it finished all the way and for a diacetyl rest for 2 or 3 days. After that, I keg it and let it chill down to 40 degrees and clear with gelatin. I've had pretty good luck turning around a lager in 3 to 4 weeks with that method. All of those were using Y-Yeast 2308 Munich lager, and the styles were Pilsners and Helles. So I asked Nate whether he lost a lot of beer to the gelatin goo at the bottom of the keg, because I have also clarified with gelatin, and you know, that's an inch or two of stuff down in the bottom that is basically wasted beer, in my opinion. But Nate said after the first couple pints or so out of the keg, the beer came out very clear. So maybe that's a way to go. The other comment Nate says the other comment is on the high gravity brew system. I have something very similar to yours that I built last Christmas. One pump, 240-volt boil coil, but I used a 10-gallon cooler set above the kettle instead of the Brunabag basket in the kettle. I've tried it a bunch of ways. Rim style, like the high-gravity one, batch sparge, using the cooler as the mash tun and pumping the sparge water out of the kettle and into a bucket/cooler that I then dump into the tun. Fly sparging, pumping the heated sparge water on top of the recirculated mash without disturbing it, and then running off all the liquid. Nate says, if I didn't already build one, I would be pretty tempted to buy the high-gravity system. Oh, there you go. Thanks, Nate. I'm impressed by people who are handy. And the older I get, the less handy I am, though, which is why I'm grateful that our sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa, built a system for me. I've been getting email asking questions about my high-gravity electric brew-in-a-bag system. And one came from listener John, who said he was trying to decide between the high-gravity system and two others, which I will not name, but you've probably seen advertised around. And John asked me what I thought of comparing and contrasting the systems. And I basically said that I like the high-gravity system because it's more like brewing with the system that I'm used to brewing with. The other two systems are more like sort of bread machines for beer in a way. And I'm sure that people make excellent beer with them, but you have to assemble a bunch of parts, and you can't reach in and stir the mash while it's recirculating, and it's just a bit too hands-off for my taste. But the high-gravity system helps you maintain and control the temperature of your mash while giving you access to the process so that you can reach in there, you can stir the mash, you can take gravity readings, you know, just like a more traditional system. Also, I said I like the idea of supporting Desiree and Dave, not only because they support us, but because they are homebrewers just like us, and their shop is family-run. When you go in there, into High Gravity in Tulsa, their grown-up kids are up in front in the business, and you may see a grandkid or two even running around the shop, and Desiree may be in the back office running the business side of things, and Dave is probably in the shop in the back of the store building these systems. So in the end, I think John was convinced and decided to go with the high-gravity system because of what Desiree replied in an email to him. I shared John's email with Desiree, and she said, Desiree said, "We strive to provide excellent support. If anything goes wrong in the first year, we fix it guaranteed. We even pay the shipping cost to return it to us for repair. Turnaround is usually just a few days plus shipping time." Then she says, "After 1 year, we will still fix it guaranteed forever. The only cost is shipping it back to us for repair." So you can't beat that. So there you go. Check out all the electric brewing systems from Desiree and Dave at highgravitybrew.com, and you can get flat rate shipping of $7.99 on ingredients and many other products. That's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com on brewing tasty triples. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
Going to talk about a beer style, if we can use that word, in conjunction with Belgian beers. a beer style that is one of my favorites. I like it quite a lot. And here in Northwest Arkansas, there's I've noticed that there's a trend among some of the professional brewers up here to say triple instead of triple. And I want to correct them. And I want to say it's triple. But, you know, number one, I don't want to seem like a jerk. And number two, I wasn't sure that I was right. Have you ever heard it pronounced triple?
I always pronounce it tripe-L.
Just to be contrary.
Like Sean Connery on Celebrity Jeopardy. No, I've always heard triple. I mean, I've heard some people call it triple, but I think, I don't know, to me that sounds like what people think it should be, not what it is.
It sounds like they're trying too hard.
It sounds almost affected to me. I think it's triple, but or triple, but now I've got it.
Well, what I did was I went back in the archives, and if you don't have the Basic Brewing app, It's really easy. All I did was I did the search thing on the app, and I put in monk, the word monk, and two episodes came up. One was Brew Like a Monk with Stan Hieronymus, and the other was Brew as a Monk, which I did a show with a monk. I think he was in Hawaii. And anyway, I listened to enough of the Stan Hieronymus interview to know two things. Number one, what an awesome interview. He's such a smart guy, and it was obvious that he knew a lot, and just talking to him about that, you know, the contents of that book was just amazing. And number two, he says triple in that interview. Now, he did say double instead of double. So he says double and triple, and I, up until now, have been saying double and triple, but I'll change one of those. Triples. Now that we've spent a good 20 minutes talking about how to say them, let's talk about how to brew them. You have written a multi-part series on beerandwinejournal.com, kind of breaking it down. But let's talk about, first of all, what is a triple?
Triple's a Belgian style of beer that was at least popularized by the Westmalle Trappist Brewery. I don't think anyone quite knows if it was actually invented by them, but it's basically a strong beer. Triples are pale beers, or that's sort of become convention that doubles are fairly strong dark beers, and triples are stronger pale beers. And most triples are, you know, they're relatively strong beers. They're highly carbonated. They're actually, as Belgian beers go, they're fairly highly hopped. Although a lot of that, it doesn't come off like an IPA like hoppiness because of the strength of the beer. It's, you know, it's just they're hopped more enough to create a balance. So even though they're fairly strong, they're very highly attenuated. So the combination of the hop rate and then being relatively dry sort of balances the sweetness from being a heavier beer. And although they can be, you know, 8 to 10% alcohol, they're typically a lot more drinkable than that. They're, you know, you think of a lot of 8 to 10% ales, and they're the sort of thing that you sip and they're, you know, nice, big and mouth-filling and chewy. And a triple is much more, you know, it's drier. It's the high level of carbonation makes it very, very quaffable, I guess, is one phony baloney beer word that people use. And so they're essentially a strong beer that's dry, fizzy, hoppy enough for balance, and ends up being tasting not so much like a strong beer.
So what sets them apart from golden strong ales?
I don't know, an arbitrary decision by somebody to call one. You know, I think the actual differences between those are very small.
Why isn't Duvel a triple instead of a golden strong ale?
Because that's how someone decided to categorize it. I'm not trying to be flip, but I think that's it. I mean, it's a very similar beer, and instead of being brewed by monks and called a triple, they're brewed by secular people and named after the devil. So maybe they didn't feel like crunching those together. But yeah, golden Belgian strong goldens are, you know, they're strong beers again. They're pale beers. They're highly attenuated. They're hoppy. I think the BJCP attempts to draw a difference by saying that Belgian strong goldens are actually slightly more highly attenuated than triples, and, you know, who knows, maybe they even are, but they're very, very similar beers.
And the name triple, as I understand it, and as I can dust off my memories of reading Brew Like a Monk, the monks brewed like a single, something they called a single, which was their like everyday beer. And then the Double was like double the strength, or double the original gravity maybe of the single, but was darker. And then the Triple was like triple the original gravity of the single, and was gold. And then on the Quad, they go back to being dark again, and being even stronger than the Triple. So that's where kind of the hierarchy fits in there. Is that right? Is that what you recall from your learnings?
Yeah, it's definitely the Double, Triple are designations of strength. I think that they're not strictly twice and three times the amount of malt. You know, there's some, you know, it's meant to hint at that, but it's not exactly that. I was lucky enough to actually visit the West Mall Brewery, and they had they brewed their single. They called their Extra, which it was not. It's generally only available for people who work at the brewery and the monks there, but they also occasionally served it, and I got some. They serve it at there's a cafe right across the street from the brewery, and so that's like a Belgian pale ale. Then they had their Double, which is a dark, strong beer. Then their Triple, and then those are the only three beers they brew. They don't quadruples or quadruples, as I pronounce them. I'm not actually sure. I think those are a fairly modern invention. I think Triple predates Quadruple by a long, long time. But I would. I suppose I should figure out if that's true before I say that. But
I'm kind of surprised that no American brewer has come up with the
quintuple. Yeah,
the quintuple in the race to the top on extremeness. Now, one of my favorite triples, and one of the reasons why it's my favorite is because I can get it, you know, at the little liquor store in Prairie Grove, Arkansas here, that's, you know, within staggering distance of my house, is New Belgium's triple, which is, I believe, around 8.5% alcohol, and they use a hint of coriander. Now, what's the tradition on spicing in triples?
Generally, they're unspiced, but, you know, as with any Belgian beer, they don't really worry too much about, you know, or they don't worry at all about styles and conforming to what other people think should be in a beer. They try to make each one individual. Generally, the most, you know, the most famous triples from Belgium, most of them are unspiced. Some of them are. Hang on, give me 1 second. I think Triple Carmelite is spiced. Let me just Google that.
In listening to the interview with Stan Hieronymus, in which he doesn't go into as much detail as we're going to on, you know, brewing this beer, he said in most examples of Belgian beers in general, the spiciness comes from the characteristic of the yeast and not actually adding spices to it. And we can talk about that in a bit when we get to the yeast part. But you know, because of the characteristics of the yeast and the byproducts, I guess you'd say, that they put out during the fermentation process, you might think that there's some spices in Belgian style sometimes, but it just may be the yeast fooling your palate.
Most triples, you know, including those brewed in Belgium, do not contain spices, but some may, because they just don't worry about brewing things, you know, to style. They try to make each beer an individual thing, and you know, they'll label it with something indicative of what it is, but if they feel like adding some spices, they will.
They're brewing art and 10 minutes of pleasure. Okay, well, let's start with the biggest ingredient by volume, and that would be water. What do we have to worry about or think about as far as water treatments or not?
Yeah, you don't need to go nuts with water treatment or find an exact, you know, water profile. If you actually look at the water that Belgian breweries use, they're sort of all over the map. Different breweries, you know, they get their water from wells or municipal sources, and they just sort of adapt to what they have. You know, I happen to know, just because I toured there, that Westmalle brews theirs with hard water, but that doesn't mean you can't brew it with soft water. My recommendation would be if you have a spreadsheet where you work on your water profile and change that, just any profile that's going to support brewing a pale beer is good. You know, I would definitely say get your calcium ions over 50 or over 100 parts per million. You'll probably, just to keep the pH down, you want your carbonate ions less than 50 parts per million. And, you know, just make it work from there with your magnesium and whatever. You don't, even though the beer is relatively hoppy, it doesn't, there's not a lot of late hopping and not a lot of flavor, and you don't really, you don't need to bring out the bitterness like you do in an IPA. So you don't really need to, have a, you know, a chloride to, sulfate ratio that's, you know, heavily skewed towards the sulfates. If you are adding calcium, I would either add it as calcium chloride or a blend of calcium chloride and gypsum. And yeah, basically I would say if you can treat your water so that your mash pH is in the right zone, that's really all you need. And unless you're attempting to clone a very specific, you know, triple from a very specific brewery, then you might need to find out about their water. But if you're trying to brew just a triple in general, you've got some pretty wide goalposts to get between. A really simple triple recipe that just works like gangbusters is just plain Pilsner malt as your base malt and a little bit of table sugar. That works great. But that being said, there are other there are other triples out there, like, you know, Triple Carmelite is the, you know, they advertise that they're based on three grains, and it's like Pilsner malt, oats, and some other pale thing. And, you know, I'm sure there's triples out there with a little bit of wheat in them, or, you know, but basically you can brew just a great triple. And in fact, a lot of world-class examples, including Westmalt, is basically just Pilsner malt is the only malted grain in there. And then the only other fermentable is table sugar. You can do some things to mix it up a little bit. Like if you, cause Pilsner malt from different, maltsters actually can have different characters. If you've tried more than one Pilsner malt and you think, I like this one a little bit, but I also like this one, you could try blending two or more Pilsner malts in there. You could also swap in a little bit of, Vienna malt or Munich malt. These are light-ish malts that give a little more maltiness, you know, and you could certainly move a little bit of those, you know, swap out a little bit of Pilsner malt and move in a little bit of either Vienna malt or a very little malt of Munich malt. So, you know, you could blend a couple base malts in your formulation. One thing you should do, though, is stay away from crystal malts or Cara, anything. You know, so many, you know, a lot of homebrew recipes come from people who they started brewing English ales, and English ales sort of by default almost always have crystal malt in them or Cara something. And so people started formulating their Belgian recipes and they just carried that over. But in this case, you don't want any caramel flavor in this beer, and you don't put Cara pills or anything like that that adds body to the beer, because there's going to be enough body simply from it being a strong beer. You want to actually make a very fermentable wort. So I guess that's a very long way of saying use Pilsner malt and table sugar for your recipe.
Now, what's our starting gravity going to be, and what percentage of table sugar are we going to use to contribute to that? How do we figure that out?
The BJCP gives the range as 1.075 to 1.085 for specific gravity, original specific gravity. And for the table sugar, at 10 to 20%, something like that, you know, if you're ambitious, maybe try to bump it up to 30, but, you know, right around 20% would be good. Enough that the table sugar not only cuts the color a little bit, but mainly makes the beer dry, because a certain percentage of the fermentables are completely fermentable and lets the beer ferment down to a slightly lower final gravity.
So we don't need to use the fancy clear Belgian candy syrup Table sugar is not going to give our beer a cidery character?
No, just use table sugar. I don't know. I was lucky enough a few years ago to tour some breweries in Belgium, and I saw many big sacks labeled sucrose sitting around, but I never saw a sack of any fancy Belgian anything, which doesn't mean it's not ever used, but I think, you know, in the most cases, they're breweries, they're in it to make money. If they can use sucrose versus something that costs way, way, way more, they're going to use sucrose, you know, just table sugar. So, and certainly in a triple, yeah, you don't need or even want, you know, at least if you're trying to brew sort of a classic example, the style, you don't really want any other flavors from your sugar. I mean, if you like that flavor and want to brew a triple with that flavor, sure, go ahead. But it's not required.
Since you're brewing with Pilsner malt, typically Pilsner malt has a reputation of having a lot of DMS precursors since it is lightly kilned. Have to boil it more vigorously or boil it longer than traditional, say, two row beers?
A 60 to 90 minute boil, nice and hard, should do the trick. There's no need for a super extended boil because given the amount of, it's a big beer, so you need a fair amount of Pilsner malt, but not quite as much as you would for a beer of that strength because you're, 20% of it ish is sugar. So you're going to get when you sparge your grain bed and run off the wort and all that, you're going to have, some volume of wort, and basically, boil that down to your target volume, however long that takes. And, that's going to be your answer. A good hard boil followed by, swift cooling should take care of any problems with that.
Let's talk about hopping strategy.
Yeah, this is really simple. Basically, use noble hops, or if you want to, just any neutral hop variety. Basically, all in the bittering. There's very few triples, at least that I know of, have any late hops. And you just add enough hops to balance out the bitterness, and you could, if you wanted to, if there was a hop that has a lot of character and you like that character, you could make it. But if you're trying to emulate a sort of Belgian style triple, use noble hops.
And what kind of IBUs are we talking about, or what kind of IBU to gravity unit ratio are we talking about? You say it's fairly crisp and bitter, but it's not IPA bitter.
Right. It's Belgian bitter, not American West Coast bitter. Yeah, the BJCP gives it as 20 to 40 IBUs. Okay, 20 would be almost nothing. I would guess most commercial styles are closer to the 40 IBUs, which is not, anywhere near as punishing as, most run-of-the-mill, single IPAs are about 60. So this is less than that. But then again, most Belgian beers are lower than 40. So, the BJCP gives 20 to 40. I would say stick around 35 to 40 for most of that. And then, of course, this is a beer that's kind of finicky, especially when you're getting the fermentation details right. Take good notes the first time you brew it, taste it, and make the adjustment to where, to where you want it. Mm-hmm. But I think your first time through, you're going to be happy. You're going to happy or close to or at the high end of the hopping level than anywhere near the low end.
And so far we've been setting a fairly neutral stage, but the character in the play, the character in our triple play, so to speak, I didn't mean that one, is the yeast. I mean, that's what brings the most interesting characteristics to this beer.
Right, yeah. Pilsner malt and, of course, table sugar has almost no flavor. And noble hops are, meant to be, they've got a flavor or whatever, but they're mellow. They're not the incredible characterful hops that, like American IPAs are brewed with. And so a lot of the distinctive character, in the aroma and flavor of a triple comes from the yeast you use. And there are, luckily for us homebrewers, there are a lot of different Belgian strains that work. And really, you know, you could use pretty much any Belgian strain that produces, you know, there's that typical, there's a little bit of an estuary character along frequently with a sort of phenolic spiciness, quote unquote, you know, that the Belgian yeasts bring. Anyone that does something like that will probably work in a triple, although you'll likely have to figure out how it works in a triple. The yeast I like is Y yeast 3787, which is our Trappist high gravity yeast. And that same strain or a very similar one is available from White Labs as WLP 530. And those both reputedly came from Westmalle. There's also Y yeast 1214 and White Labs WLP 500 are both supposedly Chimay. So those are both Trappist breweries. They both make triples. So there's, you know, a good good strain. Likewise, Y yeast 1388 and White Labs, I forget the number, but they call it Belgian Golden Ale, are supposedly, you know, the Duvel strain, which is, again, not a triple, but it's a beer almost indistinguishable from a triple. Those would work, and pretty much any of the Belgian strains would work. And what you basically want is it's a strong beer, but you ferment it so that the character from the yeast, you know, shows through a little bit, but not like hitting you over the head with a hammer, because it is a dry beer. It is a very drinkable. It should have a level of sort of, you know, quote unquote Belgian characteristics, but it shouldn't be, and it is, can be if you let the fermentation run too hot. It shouldn't be like, you know, drinking a nail polish headache. You know, it should be, it should be something where you smell it and like, oh, that's nice. Not like, oh, I need to go, you know, use this to strip the side of my house.
And also, you don't want it to be, you don't want it to be a Hefeweizen. You don't want the, you know.
Yeah, that particular blend of flavors, you don't want in a trip. That Hefeweizen sort of bubble gum and, what's the other one?
So the banana, the banana and the bubble gum and all those different
clove.
I wanted a little bit of clove stuff in there.
A tiny bit of clove wouldn't kill you, but not that particular. You know, this tastes like a Hefeweizen.
But let's talk about the mash.
Okay,
you want to mash so that you get a dry beer. You want the wort to be fermentable,
right? Your mash for a triple can be incredibly straightforward if you want it to be. You can just mash in sort of the low end of the normal saccharification range if you want. You know, I would say anything from 146 to 150 Fahrenheit, which would be 63 to 66 Celsius. Okay, that would work. Hold that for 60 to 90 minutes, stir it, and, you know, that would be a good mash. You know, if you're doing a single infusion mash, don't, you know, if you're doing a single infusion mash on a lot of ales, you can cut it short if you wanted about 20 minutes or whatever. But in this case, I'd let it go at least 60 minutes because, you know, you want the enzymes to work as much and make as fermentable a wort as possible. Another thing you can do, and probably better, would be a simple step mash. Mash in low, somewhere, you know, between 140 and 145 Fahrenheit, you know, like 60 degrees Celsius or a little bit above that. Let that go for a little while, and a little while could be 15 to 30 minutes, and then bump it up to sort of the low, not the lowest part of the saccharification range, but bump it up to, like, you know, not that the exact numbers are, but, you know, anything in the 150 to 153 Fahrenheit range would probably work pretty well, you know. So you start with the low temperature rest, which would favor beta amylase and would you know, start working on making a dry beer, and then you bump it up to the low end of the main range, and you know, just keep stirring it, let that go, you know, 60 minutes again, or again, maybe you want it to go a little bit longer, and you know, either one of those should do it. The step mash is going to produce a little bit more fermentable ale. The single infusion mash should work, you know, especially if you're shooting for a slightly higher final gravity, or also if you just, you know, for simplicity, or if you're, you know, your setup just doesn't support doing step mashes, those should work. And, you know, basically, although, you know, step mash is a little bit more complicated than a single infusion mash, but basically your wort production is pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to do a complicated decoction mash. I mean, if you had the right Pilsner malt, you could try it if you wanted, but you don't need it. And, you know, you'll basically end up with, you know, a kettle full of wort after that, which you can then, you know, at some point you'll add the sugar to. And another thing I would recommend in the mash of this is get the most out of your, you know, you're probably going to want to use, or not probably, you're going to want to use a nice quality triple malt, because that's going to be very evident, as it's, you know, the only malt in your beer. You know, it's going to be very evident the quality of that and the characteristics. Use a good malt, but also get the most of it. Like, sparge until you've, you know, until you're right up against that wall where, you know, more sparging would produce too many tannins. You know, try to get the most, that'll make a nice sort of a quote unquote grainy touch to the beer. You know, it'll accentuate the malt a little bit. And yeah, that's really pretty much it. Just like the recipe is not that complicated. The wort production shouldn't be that complicated. You know, a step mash is about as far as you need to go in terms of complications.
And again, since we're using Pilsner malt, we want to boil vigorously. And at what point do you add, and how do you add the sugar?
Yeah, boil vigorously. One thing I'd also say, because you've got a nice low-colored wort, take a look at it, and as the hot break forms, and if the hot break, if it's in big, you know, big sort of fluffy snowflake like pieces, then that's exactly what you want. If it shows up more as like just like little tiny specks and just makes the wort sort of look, you know, quote unquote dirty, try adding a little bit more calcium. Like for a 5 gallon batch, it's, you know, half a teaspoon or something like that of calcium chloride or calcium sulfate, and that should drop the pH a little bit in the kettle, which will then make the hot break look better. And then, yeah, basically you want to add all that sugar, but you don't want to, you know, you're trying to make a light colored beer, so you don't want to pour the sugar in, have it all fall to the bottom of your kettle and scorch and leave yourself with a brown, like scorch tasting ale. So the easiest thing to do is just take, if you have a small pot or any sort of container, put some of the sugar in it, some or all of it, depending on the size, and then just ladle out some wort from your kettle into there and swirl it around until it dissolves, and then add it that way. And then also stir again. If you dissolve the sugar when you add it, there's less of a chance that it'll form a clump that just sort of falls to the bottom of the kettle and then scorches. And of course, in any case, a lot of stirring when you add that is going to be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, we said we were going to talk about fermentation, the most important part. So what are the guidelines? I mean, what are we looking at?
Yeah, the thing is, as we've mentioned like at least three times now, so it's a simple, simple recipe, simple wort production. In order for the beer, you know, not to be a just stultifyingly simple, boring beer, there's got to be some character. And this character comes from the yeast, and particularly how you handle the fermentation. And it's interesting for at least two reasons. One is that when you normally ferment a high gravity ale, you know, your normal approach would be to pitch a lot of yeast, aerate very well, and, you know, control the fermentation temperature. You know, and all these things would lead to, you know, an ordered fermentation that would work well and the yeast wouldn't, you know, stall or get stuck. Okay, but all these things also, you know, higher pitching rates and higher aeration levels and lower temperatures also, they cut down on the sort of yeast characteristics that the yeast kick off, and you want some of those in a triple. You know, again, not, you know, you don't want your beer to be what I call a nail polish headache.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want that, but you you know, you want there to be some character. So you sort of got to thread the line. And here's the thing, as a brewer, you can manipulate any of those variables. If you wanted to pitch a lot of yeast but try to aerate less and ferment warm, you could try that. If you wanted to, you know, try to pitch a smaller amount of yeast but aerate well and ferment cool, you could try that. You know, they're all three, you know, like sliders on a control panel that will change your beer somehow, and they all interact. The way I like to do it is limit the pitching rate a little bit, like pitch between, you know, look up what the optimal would be, you know, you're using one of the standard pitching rate calculators, and lower your pitching rate from what they say you should do by about half to maybe three quarters.
Hmm.
So it's slightly at half, you're basically, the yeast are going to have to replicate once to reach the optimal pitching rate. Okay, so it seems, you know, sometimes if you say slightly and then say cut it by half, people, you know, well, which one? But in that, you've got to understand it's doubling. So lowering it by half is to some way of thinking slightly. So half to three quarters, that'll make the yeast, you know, they'll have to go an extra round of replication to get up to their the normal strength they would, and that would help. That'll help them produce some of the flavors you want. I would always, though, aerate well. I wouldn't try to limit the aeration to, although that does result in more yeast drive characters. I think, you know, you've got a big beer here. Treat the yeast you put in it well by aerating well, and then you know, to get the right level, it's just a question of finding the right temperature. And you know, you could either, depending on the strain, you could either do that by just experimenting, trying to find a temperature, or look up what other people have done. But what a lot of people do on a lot of these Belgian beers that works well is you start out fermenting relatively cool, and then at the end, you let the temperature rise.
Mm-hmm.
And this will give you usually the amount of, a lot of times will give you an amount of yeast character that's nice but not overpowering. If you start fermenting warm, especially when the yeast are you know, if you've underpitched and the yeast are still replicating and growing in numbers, if you start fermenting warm, you can get beers with like very blown out estuary characteristics and phenolic characteristics, and you don't want that. So fermenting cool, starting in the mid 60s or even for some of these beers in the low 60s, but then let, when the fermentation starts to, you know, starts to slow down noticeably, start letting the temperature rise. And, you know, you can let it rise up into the low 70s or in some cases in the mid 70s. It's just, you really, I mean, all these Belgian strains, which have the widest variety of, you know, sort of yeasty, interesting characters, also tend to be the twitchiest yeast, in that the little changes in variables tend to lead to, you know, larger changes. So you've really got to experiment for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
to hit, you know, especially if you're trying to hit a very narrow range of like a very specific kind of triple. You can read a recipe and follow what someone else did and probably get, you know, an adequate beer out of it. You know, one that'll be drinkable and will encourage you to try the beer again. But if you're really trying to hone in on, you know, either making a clone of a specific one or making one just to your satisfaction, you're going to have to, twiddle with the variables. Because, you know, I know a lot of people, for example, obsess about the temperature range, and they'll look up what the, you know, the brewery in Belgium Belgium brews that, you know, that beer and try to replicate that. And a lot of times it doesn't work because unless you're also replicating exactly what their level of aeration is, and, you know, as long as you're even, you know, you have to know when to start the rise, because if you start letting the temperature rise earlier, you're going to get more yeast characteristics. If you wait and let it rise later, that's going to be less. And so it's, you know, and also they're, I mean, even down to the point that they're using different equipment on some of these yeasts has an effect. So you've really got to treat these yeast. I mean, I would argue, sir, that you need to treat all yeast strains individually, but especially quote unquote Belgian-y flavorful yeast strains. You got to treat them, you know, individually. Get your, you know, brew with it once. Try to find some recommendation on using that yeast strain. Like, you know, I give my favorite profile on the website for using the Trappist, and, you know, start there and then start tweaking it for yourself, because it's gonna come out. Even if you followed as closely as possible an established recipe, your beer is gonna turn out different than the person who brewed it, and, you know, which, you know, I'm not saying to sound defeatist and like you can't do it, but it's just you've got to, you know, if you want to finally replicate something with one of these yeast strains, you've got to be really, you know, you take good notes, you got to know what the inputs are, and you've got to experiment on your own system. And, you know, I mean, the nice thing about that is it's not brain surgery either. You know, there's three big variables, and if you know how to work a thermometer, and if you're basically aerating to saturation every time, you know, then you can figure out the pitching rate. And then, you know, if you're always aerating fully, then you're really down to only two variables, just you know, the pitching rate and the curve of your fermentation temperature. You know, it can be a nice it's a nice reward if you go through a couple iterations, you know, maybe produce a beer that first is like, oh, this is drinkable, and the second one you tweak it and, hey, this is good, and the third one is like, this is what I wanted to brew. Mm-hmm. You know, that can be a very, very nice moment in you know, your brewing life. So
keep
anyway,
good notes.
Yeah, take good notes, and just recognize that another thing to recognize is these yeasts are finicky, that a little changes will. But there's also, if you try a lot of triples, there's a lot of variation out there too. There's some that have, you know, there is a decent amount of like banana in them, and they do have a lot of the yeast character. There's some that are there, you know, some that are closer to being neutral, you know, with just like a hint of that sort of, you know, quote unquote Belgian-y character. Yeah, you know, if you brew it once, no matter where you land, if it's drinkable, you know, there's probably a triple out there that's something like that, so you haven't failed. You know, you might have produced a beer that's not exactly what you wanted, but, you know, it's a beer like this, if you want to brew it well, it's going to be more than just looking up a recipe and following it once. So you're going to have at least one round of tweaking, you know. Take good notes, you know, take good notes on your temperature, take good notes on, you know, especially on your fermentation, like how many days did it go before you started the fermentation rise. And, oh, one last thing about the fermentation rise at the end. That's also going to help you hit your final gravity. And some of these yeasts, Y-Yeast 3787, but some of these yeasts tend to take them a long time to finish. You know, you'll rip through the beginning part of the fermentation and think, ooh, this is going well, and then they'll just sort of, you know, maybe not stick, but they'll sort of slow down and chug and chug and chug. So depending on the yeast you use, even with a temperature rise, you need to expect that you might be sitting there waiting for the fermentation to finish for a while. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's just some of the yeast, you know, and especially this is a big beer. So, you know, sometimes it gets down to the end and they got to, they're working pretty hard and they're, you know, at the end of a long fermentation, it's just going to take them a while. So just keep the temperature up. Don't mess with the beer. Otherwise, like I wouldn't try to, certainly don't aerate near the end to try to help it out, because you'll just make a diacetyl bomb. I wouldn't try to add yeast nutrients late, because you're just setting yourself up for problems. Just if the fermentation slows down, really the only thing you can do is just make sure that you're keeping the temperature up, and then just let it, you know, it's just going to take time.
And then packaging. You are not recommending kegging.
Yeah, kegging, I mean, here's the thing. A standard corny keg, in order, it would easily take the amount of pressure that it requires to get the, you know, amount of, you know, volumes of CO2 that you want. But then you've got, you know, if you've got a standard size, like hose, then it's just going to be shooting out of your tap like a fire hose, you know, because, you know, it's supposed to be, carbonated, you know, to at least roughly the level of champagne. You know, it's supposed to be very bubbly. So it's best to, you know, if you're brewing a triple, you're probably a fan of triple, and hopefully you'll have some of those big, heavy Belgian style bottles around. Now, your target is somewhere around 4 volumes of CO2, which is quite high. It's less than champagne. Champagne's maybe 5 to 6, but 4 is pretty high when you consider like American beers, which are relatively fizzy, are, you know, maybe 2.5 to 2.6. So jumping to 4, it's fairly highly carbonated, and you can, if your bottles aren't as thick as maybe you want, you can maybe dial that down to 3, so that, you know, you don't set yourself up for problems. But if you have the nice thick bottles, shoot for about 4 volumes of CO2, and you know, package them in heavy bottles. And, you know, if you don't have enough heavy bottles to get all of it, you probably want to, you know, put the lightly packaged bottles like in a heavy garbage bag or something, so that if one of them does pop or shatter, which doesn't happen frequently, but it can, you know, then the mess is contained. But really if you just use heavy bottles, that should save it. And if, you know, if you really want to go nuts, you can get those, you know, big heavy Belgian bottles and get a, you know, corker and the cage and all that. And those will easily withstand the pressure. And those also look, you know, you're going to be putting a lot of effort into this beer, you know, packaging it in a 750 ml bottle like that just sort of looks cool. Mm-hmm. And although, you know, you only need the special corker and all that, but that, you know, it looks neat. And also, there are a lot of Belgian breweries release their some of their triple in that format. So
and some champagne bottles, some cheap champagne bottles, you can cap. I've discovered, which is nice for sparkling meat as well. So,
yeah.
Well, this it sounds like fun. You know, of course, we're going into the cooler months, but there's still probably enough heat around so that you know, we can pull off a good fermentation of a Belgian beer before the fall.
Oh yeah, because the fermentation itself is going to be generating some heat.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when it starts to slow down, it's still, you know, if you just quit controlling the temperature, it'll get up there.
Well, I think that I want to go back to the drawing board and get more simple in my Belgian style or Belgian inspired recipes. And this the series of articles is a really good stepping off point. And it's made me thirsty. So good job, Chris.
Thanks. Yeah, triple is a beer style I really like. And I mean, one thing I think for a lot of homebrewers, especially, you know, if you've sort of mastered English ales, or even if you've gone over to you know, German style lagers and brewed that, trying a Belgian adds some new tools to your toolbox as a brewer, you know, monkeying with the fermentation details stuff. It's just a little bit it can be a beer if you're, you know, if you're sort of done all the, you know, single infusion mash, add a bunch of hops, you know, make your IPA. If you're, you know, if you've done that and you're trying, you're like, well, what else is out there? A triple is a great style to try your hands at, because it's enough. It's complicated enough that it's challenging, but it, again, it's not brain surgery. It's not, you know, if you expend a reasonable amount of effort, you're going to produce something that you really like.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Check out his series of articles on triples on beerandwinejournal.com. Chris continues to provide excellent brewing information on that site. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or please don't forget to, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You can get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can see listening to the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Not Your Mother's Clean Freak Refreshing Dry Shampoo and Creative Haven Creative Cats Coloring Book. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.